कुंज बिहारे जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवरुधारी जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवरुधारी यशोर नंदना ब्रज जन रंजना यशोर नंदना ब्रज जन रंजना यमुन तीर वनचारी यमुन तीर वनचारी जय राधो माधव कुंज विहारी जय राधो माधव कुंज विहारी जय ओम विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राज का आचार्य स्तोत्र सुत श्री श्रीमद His Divine Grace Srila Sri Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada ki jai. Kantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Nitai Gaur Premanande Hari Hari Bol Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru Gaurango. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So tonight we're going to do a verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam, second chapter. This chapter is called Divinity and Divine Service. This is text number 12. The word meanings tut that shraddhana, seriously inquisitive, munaya, sages, jnana, knowledge, vairagya, detachment, yuktaya, well equipped with, pasyanti si atmani, within himself, cha and atmanam, the paramatma, bhaktya, in devotional service, shruta, the Vedas, grihitaya, well received. Tat shraddhana munayo, jnana vairagya yuktaya, Pasyatyatmani chatmanam Bhaktya Shruta Grihitaya Tachradhana Munayo Jnana Vairagya Yuktaya Pasyantyatmani chatmanam Bhaktya Shruta Grihitaya Pasyuntyatmane chatmanam Bhaktya Sruta Grihitaya Tachradhana Munayo Jnana Vairagya Yuktaya Pasyantyatmani Chatmanam Bhaktya Sruta Grihitaya Tachradhana Munayo Jnana Vairagya Yuktaya Pasyantyatmani Chatmanam Bhaktya Sruta Grihitaya. Translation: the seriously inquisitive student or sage, well equipped with knowledge and detachment, realizes that absolute truth by rendering devotional service in terms of what he has heard from the Vedanta Shruti. So a little context here. This is the second chapter of the Bhagavatam. In the first chapter, the first three verses are Vyasadeva, the invocation verses. And then we meet the sages at Naimisharanya, who are assembled for a great sacrifice. And they have elected Suta Goswami to be the main speaker, and he's going to speak the Puranas. So they ask him six questions. And the second chapter, he begins answering those questions. One of those questions is, what is dharma? In other words, dharma, it can be translated in many ways. Essentially, it means, what are we supposed to do with our human form of life? That's essentially what the question is. How should I live my life to get the ultimate profit from it? So we just read, there's some verses leading up to this one. Now one of these, I thought I'd mention, one of his first verses by Suta Goswami. One time Srila Prabhupada, he met with this a professor, Thomas Hopkins. Some of you are familiar with him maybe. He was one of the first scholars to take interest in the Krishna consciousness movement way back at 26 Second Avenue. In fact, he met the devotees before. He was interested because he was a scholar of religion, and he heard about the devotees at 26 Second Avenue, so he went to see them. Prabhupada wasn't there at the time, so his impression was they were a little rough around the edges, these people. And then a little while later, he met Prabhupada, and he said, oh, now I see. This is what holds it all together. This person is holding it all together. So he met Srila Prabhupada, and he was trying to get Prabhupada to give him one verse. Can you tell me one verse that sums it all up? What is Christian consciousness all about? Can you give me? Prabhupada said, oh, there's so many verses. And he kept asking over, and finally Prabhupada, he settled on this particular verse. This is... let's see, what's the verse number? It's earlier in this chapter. It's Dharmasya Hyapavargyasya. That's, oh, here it is. Yes, it's text number 9. Dharmasya Hyapavargyasya Nartor Tayopakalpate Nartasya Dharmaikantasya Kama Labhaya Hismritaha Kamo labhaya hismrita. So this is the translation. All occupational engagements are certainly meant for ultimate liberation. So that tells you what you're supposed to do with your life. Occupational engagements doesn't just mean what your occupation is, but anything you do is supposed to be meant for liberation. That's what human life is for. They should never be performed for material gain. Furthermore, according to sages, one who is engaged in the ultimate occupational service should never use material gain to cultivate sense gratification. So essentially, you can see Prabhupada selected this verse because this essential point, what is human life for? That's the most important lesson, you might say, given in the Vedic literature, in Krishna consciousness. The human form of life is for self-realization. It's not for just eat, drink, and be merry and try to be happy in this world. But use your life, as Prabhupada would say, for going back home, back to Godhead, to go back to Krishna. So that came a couple of verses earlier here. And of course, the next verse also, it talks about inquiring into the absolute truth. Jivasya tattva jigyasa. Jivasya, the living being, tattva, the absolute truth, jigyasa, inquiry. So human life, we're supposed to try to find out what is the truth. What is reality? We're all in ignorance. We're born in ignorance. And most of us die in ignorance as well. We don't answer this question. We don't spend our lives investigating it. What is actually the truth? What is the absolute truth? So Suta Goswami, he actually answers in the next verse after he says you should inquire into the absolute truth. Vadanti tat tattva vidas tattvam yad jnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavan iti shabdiyate. Learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth call this non-dual substance of Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So I'll speak about this more. So that's the verse just prior to this one that we read today. So again, the translation of today's verse. The seriously inquisitive student or sage, well equipped with knowledge and detachment, realizes that absolute truth by rendering devotional service in terms of what he has heard from the Vedanta Shruti. So I'm going to go through Srila Prabhupada's purport, and I may not make it all the way through. So I'm just going to start reading and make some comments. It's a couple of pages long. The absolute truth is realized in full by the process of devotional service to the Lord Vasudeva, or the personality of Godhead, who is the full-fledged absolute truth. So here Prabhupada is essentially summarizing what I just read, Suta Goswami's answer about what is the absolute truth. It's non-dual knowledge, or actually the word there is jnana, but jnana really means consciousness, not knowledge in the sense of what you find in books, but consciousness, a cognitive faculty, consciousness, non-dual consciousness. That's advaya jnana, it's the Sanskrit. So, but it's non-dual, but still there are three aspects to it. So non-dual, you would think, well, non-dual means it's there's not two things, it's only one thing. I was thinking a very simple way of looking at this is, well, there's only one reality, right? I mean, how can there be two realities? There has to be only one reality. Whatever it is, it's one thing. I was thinking the other day about how, you know, people have all different kinds of phobias. Some of them are really strange. And I was thinking one phobia may be just about reality itself, that you're just... You know, because, why? Because, of course, it's said that we're always in fear in the material world. But in some sense, it's justified because what can we do? We're just here, and so many things are happening to us, and we feel like, well, what did I do to deserve this? Why is this happening? How did I get here? Why are these things happening to me? And I can't escape it. Sometimes people, they're angry. If they understand maybe God created me, and they think, why? I didn't ask for it. He stuck me here. I didn't have anything to do with it. So reality itself can be a very threatening kind of thing. So what we learned in the Bhagavatam is how to align ourselves with reality. Because reality, ultimately, it's love. There's a verse in the Taittiriya Upanishad that explains what is... The Upanishad is very... There's a lot of philosophical discussions there. So there's a question in the Taittiriya Upanishad, what is that truth? What is Brahman? Usually it's called Brahman, of course, the absolute truth. So there it said, Rasa Vaisa, he is Rasa. So Rasa, it means love, really. We translate it as mellows or devotional exchanges and so on, but what is that about? It's about love. So when people say God is love, actually that's true. That's supported in the Taittiriya Upanishad, Rasa Vaisa. So we shouldn't be afraid of the absolute truth. We're meant to love the absolute truth. In fact, we're part of that absolute truth. So here, going back to the purport here, Prabhupada is laying out these three aspects of the absolute truth. So there's he, but there's more to him than just something simple. It's quite complex in a sense. Even though he's one, it said there's only one thing. Again, there's one truth. Ekam Brahma Dvitiya Nasti. When I was preparing for this, I was thinking about what to speak about today. And one idea I had, although I didn't pursue it, was maybe I should explain some of the phrases that Prabhupada uses. because they're not always immediately understandable, intuitively, what Prabhupada means. So one of those verses is, the absolute truth is one without a second, or God is one without a second. Someone told me just the other day, who had been a devotee for many years, thought that this had something to do with time, one without a second, like his watch doesn't move or something. But this is actually a translation of this verse from the Upanishads. Ekam Brahma Dvitiya Nasti. Brahma, or the absolute truth, is one, Dvitiya Nasti. There's no second thing. So he's one without a second. But I was looking in the Veda base at Prabhupada using this phrase. He uses it in a couple of ways. But one, he would often say, he is one, but still he has so many varieties, so many expansions. He's one in one sense, but he also has the unlimited variety. And another way he would use this phrase is, there's only one Krishna, and he has no competition, essentially. He's one without a second, in that sense. And one, because everything is one, ultimately. Everything is Krishna, in a certain sense. You come across this, actually, even in the Bhagavatam, in many places. Even this material world, because it's his energy, it's a part of him. Anyway, so here we're talking about three aspects of the absolute truth. So here Prabhupada describes him again. Brahman is his transcendental bodily effulgence. So first, the personality of God is a full-fledged absolute truth. Brahman is his transcendental bodily effulgence, and Paramatma is his partial representation. Now, Prabhupada doesn't define what Paramatma is here, but Paramatma means the Lord in the heart. We are Atma, and Krishna's expansion in our heart is Paramatma. Param means the supreme. So the super soul, he's also called the Antaryami. Yami means controller. So he controls everything, actually. Nothing can happen without his sanction. Upadrashnanumantacha, also it says in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna uses this phrase. He's the overseer and permitter. So we may have some desire, but without the sanction or the help of Paramatma or his energies, we can't do anything unless his energies cooperate. We may have so many plans, but Krishna's energy, we have to take advantage and use Krishna's energies. So if he doesn't allow, or there's some glitch, then things don't happen according to our desire. That's Antaryami, the inner controller. Yami, or Yama. You know, yoga, there's Yama and Niyama, rules and regulations. So that's about control. And the king of control is Yamaraj. If you don't take care of your life, he'll help you control yourself. If you can't control yourself, he'll help you control. He'll control it for you, Yamaraj. So anyway, so that's that Paramatma. Paramatma is the controller within the heart. As such, Brahman or Paramatma realization of the absolute truth is but a partial realization. So Prabhupada is explaining that the personality is really the ultimate truth, and these are aspects of him. And in some sense, they're subordinate, but they're also one with him. We have these kind of paradoxes a lot in Krishna consciousness. In fact, you see them sometimes in Prabhupada's purport. In one sentence, the next sentence seems to disagree with what he just said. Because a lot of times you can say just the opposite, and that's true too. It depends on your perspective and what point you're trying to make. So that's why you have to be careful about just taking one line and saying, you know, this is it forever and ever. There's no subtlety or anything. I'm going to live my life by these three words in the Bhagavatam or something. You have to be more broad-minded, Mahatma. So it says here, let's see, then we'll go on. There are four different types of human beings. So Prabhupada just mentioned these three aspects of the absolute truth. Now he's going to talk about human beings and how they, really their alignment with the absolute truth or disalignment with the absolute truth. There are four different types of human beings, the karmis, the jnanis, the yogis, and the devotees. So people might think, there's only four? Seems like there's a lot more than four. But these are broad categories, huh? So he'll explain what they are. The karmis are materialistic. So anybody who thinks this world is where it's at, it's where you are at, but it's not where it's at. It's not the ultimate reality. It's a temporary situation. But anyone who is investing all of their energy and their life into trying to be happy and successful and satisfied in the material world, not worrying about the next life, we're not considering that there may be some reality beyond what we perceive through our senses here, that person is a materialist. So the karmis are materialists. Karmi means that you use your own energy and your new intellect and whatever you have at your disposal to try to improve your life here in this material world. That's called Prabhupada's phrase, fruitive activities. That's the karmi engages in fruitive activity. That's another one of those phrases I could talk about, I guess. It's not a common word out there in the ordinary language, fruitive activities. So fruitive activities means you're trying to get some fruit. You're planting seeds because you want to get some fruit. You want to get some results of your work. So back to this sentence. The karmis are materialistic, whereas the other three are transcendental. So that means the jnanis, the yogis, and the devotees. So I might phrase this a little bit, add a little something to this. They're transcendental really when they're in the sense that they're aspiring for transcendence. They have an idea that there's more to this world than just what we experience here. So they're, to be transcendental, they have to make some advancement, obviously. They have to actually transcend this world. So successful yogis and jnanis, they're the real transcendentalists. But at least in a sense, they're transcendentalists because they're not just tying themselves to try and be successful and happy in this through material endeavors. So the first class transcendentalists are the devotees who have realized the Supreme Person. The second class transcendentalists are those who have partially realized the plenary portion of the Absolute Person. So here Prabhupada is referring to realization of the Lord in the heart. That's the aim of the yogis. This is much more, in the Bhagavatam, of course, we read about this. It's not so much going on today in the age that we live in, but in former ages, that's what the yogis were up to, and many of them, at least, the sincere ones, they understood. They could understand themselves and they could understand the Lord in the heart by austerity and meditation. So Prabhupada says they realize a plenary portion of the Absolute Person. This is another one of those phrases. You may get plenary portion. You may get the impression that plenary means full, because that's what plenary means, full. But Prabhupada didn't use it in that way. We might be tempted to think that whenever Prabhupada uses the term plenary portion, he means Vishnu Tattva. But he doesn't restrict it to that. Basically, anything that's an expansion, a direct expansion, he tends to refer to that as a plenary portion. So here, of course, the Lord in the heart is God, a form of God himself. But in some ways, he's restricted, or he restricts himself in certain ways. You don't really have a relationship with Paramatma exactly. In some ways, you get some inspiration from him and so on. But you don't play with him like you play with Krishna and so on. So it's not a developed relationship. So the yogis, there are different relationships you can have with Krishna. The first one is called Shantarasa. And Shanta means peace. And it like Shanti. So it means being, well, self-satisfied. And one of the yogis who experience the Lord in the heart, they also experience ecstasy. But that ecstasy is a kind of awe. That's pretty much what it is. Like I think in Christianity, they have a term like the beatific vision. So they see God as just, it's overwhelming, really. They get stunned in ecstasy just by seeing, to realize that God is in my heart and to actually perceive him directly through purified senses. That's an overpowering experience. But still, that's considered lower, Prabhupada says here. The second class transcendentalist, the first class transcendentalist realizes Krishna, Bhagavan. Second class are those who have partially realized the plenary portion of the Absolute Person. Now here, I'm wondering if Prabhupada means they've partially realized the Absolute Person because this plenary portion is a partial Krishna, not exactly full Krishna. Or it may also be they get some realization, they can be called yogis if they have some realization. Most of the karmis don't have any at all. So even to get a glimpse of that light, of that person. Well, of course, the light is the next one here. Okay, the next one is, and the third class transcendentalists are those who have barely realized the spiritual focus of the Absolute Person. I like this phrase. I don't remember Prabhupada phrasing it like this in other places. So he's calling Brahman the spiritual focus of the absolute person. So earlier he said that the Brahman is Krishna's bodily effulgence. This is described in the Brahma Samhita. There's a specific verse that says this. This is the bodily rays of Krishna. So even that is amazing, actually. It's said to be amrita. Amrita means mortal, but it means deathlessness, but it also means nectar. You know, the story of the demons and demigods churning the ocean of milk, they wanted to get the amrita, the nectar of immortality. So Brahman realization is also this, the stage of realizing your immortality. Then all fear is gone. When you realize I can't be killed, I can't die, nothing can happen to me, really, because I'm not this body. So that's quite a wonderful thing, actually. We're afraid all the time of being extinguished, dying. So if you realize I'm eternal, you actually realize it. Get Brahman realization. Brahmaputa prasannatma, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. Nashochati nakangshati, that stage, then the Atma, the self, is satisfied. Actually, it's interesting, in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which is about yoga, there's a verse that talks about self-realization. Now, the acharyas, the commentators, some of them say this is about realizing the Atma, and some of them say it's about realizing the Paramatma. But in either case, it says there, when one gets this realization, one thinks there's nothing greater than this, and nothing will move me from this position, from this status. So we think, well, actually, there is things greater than that. Greater than realizing the self, greater than realizing Paramatma is realizing Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But still, it shows what an amazing experience it is to just to get Atma realization or Paramatma realization. Somehow, actually, one can stay on that plane, you might say, that intermediate plane, indefinitely, until one meets someone like Srila Prabhupada and says, that's not everything. I can tell you what's really nice. Like Prabhupada told the hippies, you like LSD? Krishna consciousness is like a whole room full of LSD. So you think Paramatma realization is nice? Wait till you see Krishna realization, right? So there's higher than that. So even though at some stage one can think, this is it. Actually, we have a whole book, this book, Brihad Bhagavatamrita, written by Sanatan Goswami. He shows devotees going through different levels, and they meet different forms of the Lord and different devotees of the Lord, worshiping the Lord. And many of these devotees, they're completely satisfied doing the kind of service to the Lord that they're doing, but they're not on the level of, we understand the highest level is the gopis. But still, from their point of view, they're completely satisfied. So that's there because Krishna, in his different forms, he satisfies different devotees in their inclination to serve him in particular ways. So not everyone is thinking, oh, I have to go to Krishna and become a gopi or, you know, manjari in the spiritual world. They're satisfied. So that's because it's Krishna. Every side of him is wonderful. One of the metaphors used for Krishna is that he's like a Vaidurya gem. So a Vaidurya gem means a gem that shows different facets and different colors come out. You know, there are certain gems like that. You shine a light on it, and maybe some purple light will come out, some yellow light will come out over here, and so on. So Krishna's like that. It's the same, he's the same gem, Krishna, the most valuable possession or thing we can acquire, person. But he chose different facets of himself, and devotees are attracted in different ways. So anyway, the point here is the Paramatma realization is also satisfying to certain persons. So I was talking here, this was in the context of Prabhupada saying, the third class transcendentalists are those who have barely realized the spiritual focus of the absolute truth. So we tend to downplay this, actually. Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which is the book, you can say, in a certain sense, about devotional service, investigating many different aspects of it. So there he says that if Brahman realization is like a drop of water compared to the whole ocean. So not much of a comparison there. So even though Brahman realization is so, you can be stunned by it and get some kind of ecstasy, the devotee thinks, oh, it's nothing. In fact, Kaivalyam Narakayate, Prabodhananda Saraswati says it's like hell compared to what the Krishna consciousness is. They're just, you can't really compare them. But still, because it's an aspect of Krishna, it's still wonderful. Actually, even to go lower, people think the material world is ecstatic, or some people do. You know, we may have experiences in this material world. You know, you win the lottery and you start crying and you're overwhelmed with happiness. So you think, wow, there's nothing could be greater than this. But that's like the devotees, they spit at that. Anything you can acquire in the material world is nothing. It's so insignificant. Of course, first of all, it's temporary. You may have heard this thing, the curse of the lottery, right? People get super rich and then their lives turn to hell because they don't know what to do with it. A lot of pressure. Sometimes I think, if I had that much money, I think I'd just give it to somebody else. Here, you take care of it. I don't want to worry about it. I don't want people knocking on my door. So everything, that's the material world too. Everything has its, you know, side effects. Just like every drug you take, pharmaceutical, it has side effects, right? The material world is full of side effects. To build high skyscraper, you have to dig deep. So there's always the other side. So that's material pleasure. So it's really not material. Material happiness is not satisfying ultimately. Okay, let me go on here. So we did the three. Then okay, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita and other Vedic literatures, the Supreme Person is realized by devotional service, which is backed by full knowledge and detachment from material association. We have already discussed the point that devotional service is followed by knowledge and detachment from material association. So this is interesting. Now Prabhupada is, now he's just jumping to devotional service because we want the person, we want to be first class transcendentalists. We want to acquire, establish our relationship with Krishna. So there are two items that are involved in acquiring that, at least in the stage of practice. Generally transcendental, these other transcendentalists also, in their practices, there are two things they're trying to do. They're trying to get knowledge, and they get that knowledge from the Vedic scriptures generally, authoritative knowledge of what to do. If you want to be a yogi or you want to be a jnani means philosopher, you can say in a broader sense. They study the Upanishads especially, and the Vedanta Sutra. Actually, in the translation today, it says, what he has heard from the Vedanta Shruti. So Vedanta Shruti just means the Vedas, or it can also mean the Vedanta. The Vedas, they have different parts to them. So they're really philosophical. There's a lot of it is about Vedic sacrifice, which is about karma, actually, going to the heavenly planets and so on. But there's also philosophical discussions. What is the absolute truth? So that's the philosophical parts are especially what's called the Upanishads. And the commentary on the Upanishads, written by Vyasadeva, is called the Vedanta Sutra. So when I read this, I was thinking Vedanta Shruti. It seems almost like Prabhupada's mixing the terms. Vedanta Shruti can mean the Upanishads, or it can also mean the commentary on the Upanishads by Vyasadeva, the Vedanta Sutra. So anyway, the transcendentalists, they want knowledge, and they understand that they have to be renounced also. So a lot of the practice, these others, the karmis and the yogis, they put a lot of emphasis on this, trying to understand, the jnanis especially, with their own intellects, unfortunately. I mean, there may be some guidance from the Vedic scriptures, but there's a lot of speculation also. Because for one thing, the Vedas are not always that straightforward. They're very difficult to understand. You really need some guidance. So you can really misunderstand. And there's also, sometimes things are phrased in a way that unless you've attained a certain level in your spiritual practice, you're not going to really understand what's being said there. They're esoteric in that way. You have to be prepared to understand. Just like anything, you know, if I open a book of astrophysics and start reading it, I'm just going to be completely lost, right? You have to kind of work your way up there, right? So parts of the Vedas are like that too. Not just anybody can pick one up. Unfortunately, people do that and they're lost because they don't know what's going on there. But there is a purpose, actually. So in any way, the jnanis, they're really into the knowledge aspect. And the yogis, jnanis and yogis, and the yogis also, they understand that you have to give up this world. To be a transcendentalist, you have to just renounce everything. That's their way of looking at it. And we know traditionally, of course, what did people do? They say, okay, I'm giving up material life, and they would go to the Himalayas, right? And perform extreme austerities. You read these things. And actually, some people are still doing them today. Like at Kumbh Mela, these people, you know, imagine living naked your whole life. And they live up in the mountains naked. And no clothing, no shelter, no plan for how you're going to eat that day. I mean, it's just amazing, actually, those kinds of austerities that people perform. Now, the one thing is, because it's so hard, people think, well, this must be the way. This must be the way to do it, right? These other people chanting Hare Krishna, they're not, how are they going to get the absolute truth? Just by chanting? Can't be. That's too easy. You got to do something hard. Actually, you can see on YouTube, you can see people with atrophied arms and all kinds of weird things because they do crazy kinds of austerities. So, of course, it is extremely difficult. The one thing, you got to grant them that they're serious about their practices. But they're misguided because that's not how you do it. That's not what impresses Krishna. Again, Krishna's Rasa Vaisa. He's love. He wants to be loved, that's all. Like we have some examples in the Vedas of people trying to please Lord Shiva by doing crazy things. Like that Vrikasura, cutting off pieces of his flesh and throwing them in the sacrificial fire. Then he was going to cut off his own head and put it in the sacrificial fire. Like, that makes a lot of sense, right? Because he wanted to get something, some reward. So people think, well, I do. So, then I'm going to impress him. What's interesting is that sometimes the demigods are impressed. They say, whoa, this person's so serious, I better do something for him. Of course, Krishna's not impressed by that. And even Lord Brahma, he gives boons, like he gave Hiranyakashipu boon. And after the whole Hiranyakashipu, Prahlad, Leela, Nrisingadev, Leela, Lord Nrisingadev said, don't do that anymore. Don't give these demons rewards like this. All they do is cause trouble. So behave yourself. Krishna is superior even to Lord Brahma, as we learn in the Bhagavatam. He can tell him what to do. So anyway, so these other transcendentalists, they're really into jnana and vairagya. But devotees, we're not so much. We're into bhakti. So let me go on here a little. Okay, he says here, oh, probably referred to, he said in the previous verse, what Krishna says is that by bhakti, automatically you get all the jnana and vairagya that you need. Sometimes devotees, because we're so, you know, we were talking about bhakti, we think, oh, we're not jnanis. So sometimes there's a question, well, aren't we trying to get some knowledge? There's different things. There's jnana and there's jnana. There's jnana, there's Krishna jnana or bhakti jnana. That's a different thing from just speculating or trying to understand the absolute truth with your own faculties. That kind of jnana, we reject that. And ultimately, we want to do more than just understand the absolute truth. We want to love the absolute. We want a relationship with that absolute truth, not just analysis. We don't just analyze God. We want to be with God. We want to be his friend, actually. We want to sit down with him and talk to him and play with him and so on. So jnana is subordinate to that. But, of course, we're learning about Krishna. That's a different kind of jnana. And vairagya means you engage in Krishna's service. You don't have to stand on your head and hang from a tree by your knees and eat the leaves or whatever thing you can come up with. You don't need to do any of those things. You just serve Krishna. Because what vairagya, Prabhupada would quote this definition, vigata raga iti vairagya, the definition of vairagya, means giving up raga. Raga means attachment. Give up your attachment to the material world. That's vairagya. That's renunciation. That's how you renounce this world. You don't have to go off to the Himalayas or anywhere else. You can live in ordinary society, chant Hare Krishna, perform your occupation, and I'd try to fill your life with Krishna as much as possible, following the orders of the spiritual master. He'll tell you how to live your life that in a way that will please Krishna. That's one of the qualifications of the spiritual master. He knows what pleases. What pleases God. How do I please God? The bona fide guru will tell you how to do that. So this jnana and vairagya, it said that by bhakti, you get them automatically. You don't have to endeavor independently or outside the realm of Krishna consciousness. So let me go on a little bit here. As Brahman and Paramatma realization are imperfect realizations of the Absolute Truth, so the means of realizing Brahman and Paramatma, i.e., the paths of jnana and yoga, are also imperfect means of realizing the Absolute Truth. Now this sentence, a really wonderful sentence, is basically a rephrasing of the verse, the particular verse that this is a purport to. Very nice. Kind of ties it all together. Devotional service, which is based on the foreground of full knowledge, combined with detachment from material association, and which is fixed by the oral reception of the Vedanta Shruti, is the only perfect method by which the seriously inquisitive student can realize the Absolute Truth. So these knowledge and renunciation, they're in some ways supportive, at least in the beginning, of the practice of devotional service. But then at the heart of it all is hearing from the Vedic literature. There has to be an author, an authority, a transcendental authority. How can you understand what's in transcendence? That's the whole problem with modern science. They're trying to understand the truth, supposedly. Science is the search for truth. But they're limited. Their truth, they'll never get beyond material sphere into transcendence. And there's so much, of course, we don't want to make a generalization about scientists, but those who are philosophically inclined, they reject the idea, possibly, that, you know, that there is something beyond. We can explain everything with material laws. But there's so much evidence that there's more than just what's happening with material laws. And in fact, they can't even explain themselves. So many things in this world. Some years ago, I've been looking for it ever since. I can't find it now, but I saw a video. It was given at a Christian conference by a Christian scientist. And he went through all the planets in our solar system and explained how every one of the theories that we have about this planet and that planet and that planet has got full of holes in it. Really, things that are irreconcilable. This just can't be because of this. But this is where we stand right now in our explanation of, you know, why Saturn has its rings or why it's in this particular orbit or whatever it is about it. So science is full of this kind of thing. It's full of doubts. They may present a face that we all agree on these things, but it's not actually true. So even if they're lost in trying to figure out this universe, what to speak of what's beyond, if there's anything beyond. So you have to hear from beyond, as Prabhupada would say. If you want perfect knowledge, you have to hear from the perfect person. Now, of course, people will doubt that. Well, there is nobody perfect. Nobody knows anything. But we who are accepting the Vedic script, you know, we're reading Srimad Bhagavatam, accepting it as authority, we're seeing that there's a word for it, svata pramana, which means self-evident. When you study this, you say, oh, this really is a book about the Absolute Truth. And it really has a lot of things to say about the Absolute Truth, and it has a lot of convincing things to say about the Absolute Truth. That was, of course, Srila Prabhupada's power. Part of his power was he was so convinced. So conviction is contagious. They say that about selling. If you want to sell something, you have to be really enthusiastic about your product, and then the customer will be enthusiastic about it too, right? So Prabhupada was certainly enthusiastic about the product that he was selling Krishna. He couldn't stop talking about him, actually. He was so much in love with Krishna. He was infatuated with Krishna and trying to show everyone else. Why not? Actually, that's interesting. Sometimes when Prabhupada would make some point, he would say, why don't they understand this? I heard him say that recently, that he was talking about how we're not this body. He said, it's such a simple thing to understand. Why don't they accept it? So people are rebellious, and they don't want to understand. There was one scientist who admitted, he said, we're trying to prove that matter is everything because we don't want to be, essentially, we don't want there to be a God. We don't want to be judged. We don't want to be held responsible. So if we can prove there's no God, then we don't have to worry about it. We can sleep at night and do anything that we want. So anyway, it's getting late here. I'll save a little time for questions. If the purport goes on, we won't be able to finish it. Actually, Prabhupada goes on, he talks about different, he likes to put things in categories. He talks about different levels of devotional service. So if you want, you can go back, go and read the rest of this purport. So I'll stop here, and if anybody has any question, I'll take them. Other not, if not, I'll return to the purport, but let's pause here, see if anything has anybody has anything to ask. Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. I've been wondering about this for a few days. Like, yeah, we need to slowly, eventually develop the higher tastes and get more detached with the material business and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But like, yeah, even like sometimes like I oversleep or just overeat or like just fall into some Maya traps. But I feel like Krishna is still sanctioning that. So is that all right to think that Krishna is still very kind and merciful that he's allowing me to...
There's a nice verse by Krishna in the 11th canto in the Uddhava Gita where he sanctions the devotee, the practicing devotee. He admits that, yes, sometimes there's going to be stumbling on the path. But he said, just go on. Don't worry about it too much. Essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but he says, just, you know, you get your sights on the goal. There's going to be some problems along the way. You may trip here and there. But don't give up. That's the main thing. Keep your eye on the prize and keep progressing. And, of course, we also have to understand that it's going to take some time. We've been in this material world a long time. And we have bad habits that are deeply ingrained in our consciousness. So it takes a lot of scrubbing to get rid of that. But fortunately, we have the process. So that's the main thing. You know, we have to be a little hard on ourselves, but not too hard, where we get discouraged. Just do what Prabhupada did and keep moving forward step by step. It's like, I know I haven't done it myself in a long time, but I haven't done much like hard hiking, but I know devotees have gone on pilgrimage to some place in the Himalayas, and it's really a trek. It's really difficult. And they say, you know, you say to yourself, just one step, next step, one step after the other, just going the next step, the next step, the next step. So sometimes spiritual life may feel like that. Even the next step is hard to take. But let me just take that next step and the next step and just keep going, and eventually you'll get there. Like Bhakti Marg Swami, he takes step after step, goes from coast to coast, across Canada a couple of times, across the United States. Step by step, you'll make it. In the beginning, you might think, boy, I got a long ways to go here. But you make it, you keep going. Yes, Prabhu, in the back.
Yes,
Michelle.
In the Vedas, it's mentioned that we can rejoice in the self, as I guess, when we're advanced.
Yeah.
Is there anything you can say or talk about that a little bit? Because we're always about chanting and being loud and everything. You know, sometimes by the indirect, you know, process, you know, you can go through a meditation like Vipassana or something like that, and it's not religious at all, but for some reason, after many days of that practice, there's something that comes up that is actually very spiritual, and, you know?
Yeah, there are different levels of realization, different ways to look at that. It's interesting that Krishna talks about that in Bhagavad Gita, because really, in practice of devotional service, it's not something we emphasize so much. We're more interested in developing our bhakti. Rupa Goswami, in his Nectar Devotion, what is he talking about? How to progress step by step. And he doesn't talk about Atma Tattva Gyan or Brahman realization or even Paramatma realization. So our focus is on devotional service to Krishna. And along the way, we may get some realization, and it may be quite enlivening, actually. But it's not what we're aiming for. So it's not like there's a lot of instruction, you might say, from our acharyas, how to become self-realized. Although Prabhupada did sometimes talk about that, especially to newer people, you can become self-realized. There's one interview, some journalist asked him, you know, how did you get people to follow you? And he said, I told them if you chant Hare Krishna, you'll become self-realized. And they believed me, essentially. So they took it up, and you can see how they are purifying themselves. But yeah, even like people who are practicing ordinary yoga, if they try hard enough, they may get some glimpse. if you really endeavor for trying to get rid of all these thoughts that are coming in and try to focus on who am I really, although it's really difficult, and how much they actually realize, it's hard to say. But potentially, there is some potential for that. But it's not something that we're really exactly aiming. We're aiming to love Krishna and develop our love for Krishna. That's what our focus is on. That's where we place our attention. Whatever happens along the way, that's nice. But we want the nectar of serving Krishna. Okay, we'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.